will get yours. Thank you. It's obviously both an honor and a privilege to be able to address you as the president of the Southern Thoracic Surgical Association. Many gifted surgeons have preceded me in this role, and I'm sure that when you remember the long line of superlative physicians who've served in this capacity, you'll all be struck by the same thought. What the hell is Keith doing up there? And what was that nominating committee smoking that evening? Regardless, I have the privilege of addressing you, my friends and colleagues in the SCSA. In order to learn how to comport myself during my presidency, I sought out Mike Mack for advice. And you know Mike, he uttered a single word, gravitas. I personally wasn't absolutely certain what that meant. I thought I remembered from medical school it was some sort of intestinal gas. But Mike corrected me and said that gravitas is a quality, a substance, or a depth of personality, and that I could learn from his example that he actually possessed gravitas. Gravitas? Well, I don't know if it was the straw hat. Maybe it was the stupor while he was moderating. It could have been, I don't know, maybe it could have been riding that stupid model horse with his thumb in the air, or perhaps when he was shopping with Barbara. I must now surmise that gravitas means one is capable of making an ass of oneself in public. And thank you, Michael, yes, for convincing me I have a gift for this job. Rich Prager has already given you a mini travelogue of how I came to hold this position in this place and at this time. Like everyone else who stood here, I realize that anything that I have accomplished has as much to do with the efforts of others as it has with any of my own. And because of that, some thanks are in order. During my first year in medical school, I decided to spend the summer in the cardiac physiology lab with this guy, Bob Replogle. He was the chief of cardiac surgery at the University of Chicago, and as any of you who know Bob are aware, he's got a somewhat rough exterior, but that camouflages a man of warmth, endless humor, and insight, plus a slight penchant for profanity that would make a sailor blush. The morning that I first met him, the very first sentence out of his mouth was so funny and so profane that I thought he had to be like a truck driver or a drill instructor or something. And the lab and the staff, they assured me, say, no, he's actually a cardiothoracic surgeon. And I can remember thinking to myself then, maybe I have a future in that too. At the University of Chicago, I also walked in the shadow of these three gentlemen, as Rich said. I think of them as the holy trinity of esophageal surgery. This picture shows David Skinner looking in over Tom DeMeester, who's performing a case and being assisted by Sir Ronald Belsey. Although I have no inkling of who the patient actually was, I can guarantee you that he couldn't swallow worth a lick before the operation and only had a 50-50 chance after. It was through the influence of these three gifted surgeons that I became drawn to the practice of thoracic surgery. They were the stars, they were the studs, the cool guys. My goal was then, as it is now, to become a master surgeon like them, and it continues to be a work in progress. I stayed at Chicago for both my general surgery and my cardiothoracic residency. As this picture will attest, I wasn't the only one to fall under the spell of Dave Skinner and company. My co-residents, several of whom appear in this departmental photo, included Alex Little, Mark Ferguson, Carlos Pellegrini, George Wernley, Jim Levette, Nasser Al-Torki, Walter Scott, and Daryl Wyman, all of whom continue in academic thoracic surgery to this day, and all of whom remain close friends. I consider myself very lucky to have been in the right place at the right time and certainly working with the right people. When I finished in 1985, I landed my first job, and as you heard, it was at St. Louis University, hired by George Kaiser, with Valley Willman, Rick Barner, Glenn Pennington, Larry McBride, Art Bowie, and indeed it is true that three of these went on to become presidents of the Southern Thoracic Surgical Association, as has my current senior partner, Bill Sasser, and I am honored to be the fifth member of the St. Louis University faculty to serve as the STSA president. I'm also indebted to my current colleagues at St. Louis University, Rick Barner, Bill Sasser, Robbie Johnson, Emily Farkason, and Andy Fiore. They're the reason for the continued success of our division, and their efforts allow me to have the time to serve both the STSA and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. I must also thank the administrative staff who are pictured here, especially the young lady on the left, my administrative assistant, Laura Bianchi. Our relationship could best be characterized by that age-old axiom, do you want to talk to the man in charge or the woman who knows what's going on? We've worked together for nearly 24 years, and I could not have achieved a fraction of what I've accomplished without her efforts. After all, someone in the office had to be organized, thoughtful, and mature, and that sure as hell didn't mean me. Laura is here today with her daughter, and I'd like to publicly thank her for her patience, devotion, and effort. Finally, my family's with me today. I, of course, am very deeply indebted to my parents for their love, support, and devotion. Unfortunately, my mother passed away 2 years ago, and that's a shame. I'm really sorry you didn't get a chance to meet her. You would have loved her. She was a woman of wit, intelligence, grace, and charm, and would have fit in very well here at the Southern. And such wit, intelligence, grace, and charm, I think I'm adopted, probably. But my father, 86 years young, is here today. He actually insisted on coming to find what kind of misguided organization could possibly have elected his idiot son into office. I'm also supremely grateful to my wife of 32 years, Roseanne, who in addition to her full-time job as a professor of medicine at Washington University, has raised four children, outstanding children, almost single-handedly. I promise you I was there at the beginning for each one of them, but after that, my involvement probably waned. I was gallivanting around the hospital or around the country going to meetings. But my children are here today. The eldest, Kate, once again, a financial analyst. Ted, a third-year law student. Matt, a fourth-year medical student. And Molly, a fourth-year medical student. Second-year medical student. I've already got you advanced, dear. She's at the University of Chicago, which, as you know, is our alma mater. My message to my children is a simple one. I'm extremely proud of the people that you've become. And thank you for all the joy you've provided to your mother and myself over the years. Oh, and don't do drugs. This talk, we always have to get that one in, right? This talk is a privilege to present, but it's also proved to be a burden of some sort over the last year. I use the word burden because I believe the presidential address is a love-hate experience for almost every society president. On the one hand, one can't help feeling honored. You're the anointed. You're the chosen one. You've been given the privilege of giving the presidential address. On the other hand, there's significant pressure to deliver a lecture that will both inform and energize one's colleagues on a topic pertinent to the specialty. And like every other president, I live in my greatest fear is a wave of boredom and mass somnolence will replete with snores, grunts, and unseemly drooling will occur. To prevent just such an event, I sought out the advice from three of my friends who I greatly admire. You know, Irv Krohn is a great leader in thoracic surgery, Tor Suntz a superb clinician, and Rod Landrino is one of the most daring and innovative surgeons I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. But then, thinking about advice, I researched their backgrounds a little more deeply, and I felt maybe my confidence was somewhat misplaced. Why would you take advice from anyone who proudly wore a one-eyed monster hat, a full-body thong, or a pimp costume? Therefore, I decided instead, no, these were not the advisors I should be seeking. They're just costumes, after all. Instead, I sought out, they're never going to forgive me, I sought out our past presidents, looking for advice regarding a topic. I first called Bob Sade. You know Bob Sade. He's our resident saint and the do-gooder of the SDSA. As you might expect, Bob suggested an address dealing with a philosophical topic, and when I pressed further, he suggested perhaps best to address a fundamental ethical dilemma or some profound danger that faced our association. I asked him which danger he was referring to, and he said that my election to this office was about as profound a danger as the SDS had ever faced. Way too honest, Bob. I then decided I wanted advice from someone who's demonstrated both imagination and good judgment. So my next call went to Ross Ungerleiter. You remember Percival? But I never did get to talk with him. His wife, Jamie, told me he was unavailable because he was in the bathroom playing Dungeons and Dragons and wouldn't come out. There was some unsolicited advice. Randy Chitwood called me to offer his thoughts on topic selection. You all know Randy. He's the common man of Southern thoracic surgery, the kind of down-to-earth guy who has a hankering for guns and girls and grits. He's so Southern, he actually changed his academic title at East Carolina to the NASCAR professor of surgery. Well, anyway, Randy called. He was talking in that thick Southern country boy drawl that he uses, and I think he was proposing a topic for my address. I'm pretty certain he was, but I only really understood two words. One was cousin, and the other was tater. And I wasn't certain exactly what they meant, because I'm not fluent in Bubba speak. But I wished him and his hound dog Blue a good day, and I decided to move on. My final call went to my friend Carolyn Reed, or Queen Carolyn, as she is known to her close friends. Carolyn and I have been friends for 25 years, and she is one of the most prominent women in thoracic surgery. I asked her what my topic should be, and she suggested I play to my strengths. That's a good idea. I waited for her to enumerate those strengths, but after 15 seconds of dead time on the phone, I suggested to her perhaps I could speak on the importance of the women's movement in cardiothoracic surgery. She told me that if I tried that, it would make a mockery of the efforts of people like Elizabeth Blackwell, Gloria Steinem, Susan B. Anthony. And I said, who the hell are those chicks? I believe it was at that point she actually hung up on me. In truth, I did speak with many people about this talk, and there was one common theme to the advice from all of them. To a person, they advised me that my address should deal with an issue or issues about which I feel passionate. I thought about that and realized there are a myriad of issues affecting thoracic surgery which incite within me real emotion. Take, for example, the 80-hour work week. I do recognize that this limitation of resident hours has been beneficial to the personal lives of the residents and their families, and that's great. But frankly, although it's politically incorrect to say it, the work week limitation is otherwise a pile of horse pucky. It was instigated by a media mogul who insisted resident fatigue was responsible for the tragic death of his daughter. The concept that resident fatigue resulted in harm to patients was sexy enough to be picked up and trumpeted by the press, sensationalized in congressional hearings, and ostensibly corroborated by a series of articles out of Boston, which I consider to be a sophisticated junk science. The ACGME swallowed this whole, bowed to the pressure, and mandated the limits we have at this day. This was all done with absolutely zero credible evidence. Zero evidence that prolonged work hours endangered patients. In the last 6 years since the limits instituted, there's little or no data documenting increased patient safety. And in fact, the data strongly suggests that patient safety may have been compromised due to faulty communication during handoffs. And in addition, I and a great many educators believe the resident education has suffered significantly. Passionate? Yeah, it ticks me off. I'm a little passionate about that. Another sore spot's like electronic health records. It's been instituted at our hospital. Admittedly, there's some bright spots, you know, good access to imaging, simultaneous access to charts, etc. But it's a huge cost, both financially and professionally. It's hard to swallow for most medium-sized practices, and from the professional standpoint, it's been universally noted that it decreases clinical productivity. With virtually all the programs, physicians are forced to do clerical work previously done by nurses and by secretaries, and the interoperability remains a significant problem. Frankly speaking, the push for EHR came not from practices, not from practicing docs, but from media, industry, and government bureaucracy. Yeah, I'm a little passionate about that too. And so I realized there were so many issues that anger or puzzle not only me, but most of my colleagues in thoracic surgery. Pick one: Medicare SGR, the CT applicant shortage, the imposition of the MOC, the maintenance of certification, HIPAA rules, any number of items in the recently passed healthcare reform bill. The common theme for all these issues is change being forced upon us from outside the profession. Thus, I decided to direct my address to the topic of change and how we as thoracic surgeons deal with it now and in the future. I first realized CT surgeons sometimes have trouble changing with the times about 15 years ago when my boss, George Kaiser, walked up to me one evening. I was standing at the shredding machine, tossing in, destroying old patient files. He hurried up to the machine and said, some documents. He said, thank God you're here. This new technology it's so hard to keep up with. I really need help with the machine. Can you feed these in for me? I said, sure. He handed them to me. I fed them into the shredder. He turned, put his arm around me, and said, thanks, Keith. I only need a couple of copies. I was not his favorite person that day. True story. Sorry, George. Every human being tends to become set in his or her ways, and thus change is an uncomfortable, if not fear-provoking, process for virtually all of us. However, it's both important for us personally and for our specialty that with regard to change, we see both sides of the coin. We must recognize that it is inevitable, yes, sometimes unpleasant, but we should also realize it's potentially invaluable. In fact, change is integral and necessary for the survival of our specialty. But cardiothoracic surgeons may not handle ongoing changes quite as well as other specialties. When you think about it, that's not really a huge surprise. Let's face it, thoracic surgeons historically have not been recognized as really flexible individuals, sensitive to subtle shifts in their surroundings, or who welcome the idea of fundamental change. Just ask any one of our spouses. According to Betsy Urschel, it takes a major tectonic shift in the Earth's crust to get Hal off his rear end to do anything around the house. You have to ask yourself why that would be, and the answer, honestly, is quite simple. Think back to your own career selection, and more importantly, to those who guided and enabled your selection of cardiothoracic surgery as a career. What character traits do you think the chairman of thoracic surgery looked for and selected for 30, 20, even 10 years ago? Certainly intelligence was a factor. We're all intelligent, but so were the geeks who went into internal medicine. I would suggest to you that we were not chosen primarily for sensitivity, flexibility, or a willingness to compromise. We were selected for reliability, stamina, and the emotional toughness to follow orders and see a task through to completion. Most of us were not chosen because we had a gift for independent thought or innovation. On the contrary, we were chosen at least in part for our ability to follow orders. I doubt there was ever a single Duke trainee who said, "Gee, Dr. Sabiston, I know what you said to do, but I had a better idea, so I did it differently." Well, it is possible there were one or two trainees who said that, but I can guarantee you they didn't finish the program. And I'm not trying to impugn Dr. Sabiston or Duke University. It was the same, you all know, at Mass General, Hopkins, Michigan, Mayo, even the University of Chicago where I trained. Let's face it, deviating from the prescribed path was not a good career move. We as residents were never invited to change anything. How often did you hear my way or the highway? We came to accept the way we trained was the gold standard, and we've tried to perpetuate that same system for our trainees. We're now under external pressure to change that system, and frankly, we don't like it. We want what we want, when we want it, and the way we want it. There is, after all, more than a kernel of truth, that version of the old light bulb joke. How many thoracic surgeons does it take to screw in a light bulb? Just one. He puts the bulb in the socket, and the world revolves around him. But it's not that we absolutely refuse to change, although we as individuals tend to resist change. Our specialty has evolved continuously in the clinical arena, and in fact, that's the only reason our specialty has survived over the past 100 years. The whole history of cardiothoracic surgery is one of slow and constant change with a capital C. Thoracic surgery was actively performed over a century ago, and at that time, tuberculosis was known in the vernacular of the day as consumption. Consumption was initially treated by intrathoracic lysis of adhesions or thoracoplasty to collapse the lung. Eventually, treatment involved resection of diseased lobes and segments. But once effective medical antituberculous treatment became available in the 1950s, a large fraction of the thoracic surgeon's business disappeared into TB sanatoria. But simultaneously, our practices were changing as well. While one source of practice of our patients vanished, another appeared after Evarts Graham attacked the second C on the list, cancer of the lung. In 1933, Evarts Graham performed a successful pneumonectomy for cancer, opening up a whole area of practice for the thoracic surgeon. The next C in our evolution represents congenital heart disease, first successfully treated by Dr. Gross, who performed a PDA ligation in 1938. The Blaylock-Taussig and soon follow within a decade, and thus congenital heart surgery was off to the races. Cardiac valvotomy was next, and was first successfully performed by Horace Smithy in 1948. This represents the inception of modern-day valvular surgery. Coronary bypass was next, accomplished by Goetz, Kolosoff, and Favaloro independently, all in the 1960s. First it was done off bypass, then it was done on pump, then it was done off pump. Now it's done on pump. If you guys can't make up your damn mind, I don't know what the hell you're doing in thoracic surgery. Congestive cardiac arrhythmias. Treatment of this was initiated in 1968 with the successful division of an accessory AV bundle for Wolf, Parkinson, White, and since that time, ablation procedures for VTAC and atrial fib have been developed. Congestive heart failure was surgically addressed, first by transplantation and more recently by VADs and ventricular remodeling, and COPD has been attacked surgically using lung transplant and lung volume reduction. Within the past 20 years, the changes have been so fast and so furious that they've served to further demonstrate that CT surgeons can and do change, at least in the clinical arena. And for us to survive as a specialty, this change will have to continue as medical science evolves. Our procedures are sometimes supplanted by medical advances, as happened with streptomycin, which stopped TB surgery. Many of our current bread and butter procedures may decline due to such therapeutic advances, whether it be stereotactic radiosurgery for lung cancer, umbrellas and coils for congenital defects, percutaneous valves for acquired valvular disease, stents for coronary artery disease, or catheter ablation of arrhythmias. Our specialty must continue to evolve and explore new frontiers if it is to survive. And so far, we've been damn successful. But the key to our successful change, the factors that make us willing to change, are really two in number. First is the existence of definitive evidence, hard data, which supports the proposed change. We are by nature a relatively conservative and skeptical specialty, but once definitive evidence is provided, documenting prolonged survival or improved function, we can change with the best of them. The second and perhaps more important factor is that of autonomy. That is to say, we are more willing to change when the decision for change is ours and not foisted upon us by outside agents. We want to control the decision process, and as all our spouses and children know, there is no bigger control freak than a cardiothoracic surgeon. So we recognize it's difficult, but we can change when we try. You can just look at the audience and see shining examples. Take Gus Mavroudis, for example. When I first came to know Gus, he was a young surgeon, young, petulant, impatient, some would say boastful. But take a look at him now, he's changed. He's old. The petulance, the impatience, the boastfulness. I think I'd rather take on water to wine and loaves and fishes before I try and change that. For most of the 20th century, CT surgeons were on top of the pile and in charge of their own practices. But now we've entered the 21st century, and suddenly external forces are increasingly being exerted upon us, pressuring us to make changes in all arenas and all areas of our professional lives. These are not pressures for clinical change. As we've seen, we can handle that ourselves. These are changes outside our comfort zone in the fiscal, social, political, and educational arenas. However, unlike the clinical realm where science and hard data abound, there is a dearth of evidence for any of these non-clinical changes. Such changes appear to be pushed ahead not by evidence, not by hard data, but rather by whim, prejudice, media frenzy, public opinion, or regulatory fiat. The combination of a dearth of supportive evidence and our loss of autonomy lead us to resist such change. There are many such examples. I've mentioned the 80-hour work week, electronic health records. There's PQRI, the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative. You know, there's specialty-specific quality guidelines. They mandate specific processes of care, but though we had to give them lists of it, we didn't have that idea. It wasn't our idea to do it. They don't measure any real clinical outcomes, and there's no evidence that they're improving patient care to date. Another mandate from outside we were not happy to have. Electronic health records, six competencies of maintenance of certification. The ABMS attempted to answer the challenge from the Institute of Medicine to objectively and quantitatively measure clinical competence. Critics complain about expense and paperwork, and certainly this is not going to be optional in the future. The medical home concept, one of my faves. A concept to revamp Medicare patient, an appealing idea, but there is no data. Zip. Zilch. Nada. No hard evidence that these changes will either lower expenditures or improve outcomes. In the published pilot projects, as a matter of fact, costs actually increase without improvement. An appealing idea, government loves it, media hype, there's a burning sense of frustration on the part of primary care physicians, but no data. In general, these types of changes have not been warmly embraced by CT surgeons, and from the tenor of my remarks, you might naturally think I'm against these changes, that I would want to fight them tooth and nail and urge you to do the same. And you would be wrong. Dead wrong. I hate them. It's obvious I don't like them any more than you do, but actively fighting these at the present time will make no sense. It's kind of like arguing with your wife. even if you win, you end up losing. Our goal should not be to stop or to reverse these changes. That's really not it. That's like trying to beat back the tide. Instead, we need to respond constructively and try now and in the future to guide such changes for the betterment of our patients. Learning to manage such change, both personally and professionally, would be one of the most constructive and educational endeavors our specialty could undertake. One of the first things we have to do is quash the notion that any of us can hold on to the status quo and just ride out the rest of our careers in blissful ignorance. Change is going to continue whether you want to participate or not. If your practice or your division or your department is not changing so much you can hardly stand it, then it's not likely to be around 5 years from now. If you choose not to participate, you will be left in the dust. My job, your job, our job is to deal with that change as effectively as possible, both for our own benefit and for that of our patients. Change is hard for all human beings. Experts suggest there are four basic responses evoked in those confronted with change. Some will be dismayed and react by whining. Such people take little or no action, but will grumble continuously. The second group is known as the bystanders, those who stand apart, neither supporting nor opposing the change. These folks just want to stay under the radar and maintain the status quo. The third group is comprised of the critics, those angry and vocal people who complain loudly about the injustice and actively oppose any sort of change. And finally, the navigators, those who tend to be the early adopters, who recognize some form of change is inevitable, look at the globe, look at the map, participate in the process with hopes of guiding the change in the direction that proves to be constructive. We as cardiothoracic surgeons need to take a hard look at ourselves, recognize which of these groups we're in, and decide how we plan to cope in the future. While some whining may be emotionally rewarding, it obviously does nothing to address any problem. Taking a role as a bystander on the sidelines may avoid stress in the short run, but there will come a time to pay the piper. And lastly, getting angry and becoming a vociferous critic, it may be cathartic, but anger is rarely constructive and tends to impede progress. The best response we can have is also the hardest to carry out. That is to actively engage ourselves in the process of constructive change, navigating towards the best possible result. This requires intelligence and perspicacity, two attributes we as thoracic surgeons possess in spades. But it's also advantageous to demonstrate flexibility and capacity to compromise. That, frankly, is not our strong suit. Our specialty is populated by some of the most intelligent, energetic, and capable human beings on the planet. Now we just need to make a conscious effort not to whine, not to sit on the sidelines, and not to complain angrily about what's just not fair. Our goal must be to navigate the change ahead of us, and for that we have some great role models right here at the Southern Thoracic Surgical Association. Just a few years ago, the specter of catheterization-based replacement loomed large on the horizon, and some of our profession predicted that percutaneous valve replacement would effectively supplant open repair and replacement, thus rendering surgeons unnecessary. Most of us just moped or whined, some stuck their heads in the sand, and many got angry, but not Mike Mack. In conjunction with Fred Moore, Craig Smith, Joe Bavaria, and others, he acquired the technical skills to participate in minimally invasive procedures such as that. These investigators fostered cooperation between surgeons and cardiologists, and in doing so, helped institute the partners trial. Perhaps more importantly, Mike and others are holding training symposia to pass on these skills to other surgeons so that we might all better prepare for the onrushing future. Because of Mike Mack and other surgeons like him, CT surgeons will now have a solid foothold in this area. But important change, once again, is also rapidly occurring outside the operating rooms. And there are additional exemplars of navigational change within our association. We all know about the crisis with regard to attracting adequate applicants for CT surgery training, not only with regard to the quantity, but to the quality of those applicants. Not only are there far too few applicants, but most faculty have sincere doubts regarding the quality of the incoming group. I have to admit that I've been as guilty as anyone of futile behavior, including whining, ignoring the problem, and losing my temper. None of these responses has anything done to address the problem constructively. But SCA members like Rick Fines have stepped in to try and make changes to fix these problems. Rick, as you know, was the chair of the American Board of Thoracic Surgery and the board's long-recognized declining interest in our specialty. Rick championed the initiative for the 6-year integrated training program. Last year, there were 8 such programs certified by the RRC, offering a total of 9 training slots. That seems like a paltry number compared to the 110 training slots now available in the remaining 72 programs. And you might ask yourself, how can these 6-year programs possibly address our manpower, our workforce crisis? Well, last year, there were 91 applicants for the conventional training program, and only 55 were graduates of U.S. medical schools. But for those 9 integrated 6-year training slots, there were nearly 120 applicants, and they included the cream of the crop, AOA kids, summa cum laudes, outstanding recommendations. That's a 12-to-1 ratio of applicants to training slots. Now, I'm not telling you that the 6-year training programs are a panacea. We have no idea what the attrition rate will be, nor can we confidently claim that the graduates of those programs will be as well or better trained than we were when we finished. But I can state with certainty that we were sure as hell not going in the right direction, both either with regard to quantity or quality. The solution may not be perfect, but at least it gives us a fighting chance to once again attract the best and the brightest. Others have addressed the scarcity of applicants in other ways. Just look around you in the room today, look to your left, look to your right, and just count the number of female cardiothoracic surgeons in this group. You can count on your fingers and your toes if necessary, but chances are you won't have to take off your shoes and socks. A paltry 3% of our specialty is comprised by those of 2 X chromosomes. But 50% of every medical school is now female, and we can't attract them when we are missing out on at least half the best applicants. We'll be doomed to shortfalls in our workforce. Admittedly, our profession may not be an easy sell to women, and in truth, male CT surgeons are not the best salesperson for the job. Many thoracic surgeons sincerely believe they can draw female applicants on charm alone because they themselves are irresistible. It's best not to name names, but you know who they are. Guys like Kurt Tribble, Rob Serfolio, and probably the worst of all, Danny Miller. They think they can draw female applicants on charisma alone. But you could strip these guys buck naked, dip them in a vat of pheromones, and they still wouldn't attract women. But Carolyn Reed also recognized these obstacles and this problem, and she decided to navigate the problem. She was one of the first to call attention to our gender gap and identify it as a serious threat to our specialty. While others whined, dawdled, or raged about the shortage, Carolyn helped found the Women in Thoracic Surgery. And through this organization, Carolyn and others have kindled interest in cardiothoracic surgery among women medical students and actively mentored many of them into our specialty. As to the problem of the quality of training program, many program directors found incoming trainees lacked significant exposure to CT surgery during their residency and were thus uninformed about the rudimentary practices in our specialty. Enter the navigators, SCS members like John Calhoun, Walter Merrill, Rick Fiennes, and James Phan. They recognized the problem and decided to work towards a solution. They designed and implemented the TSDA Cardiothoracic Surgery Bootcamp for incoming residents with the intention of jumpstarting their training. During this live-in boot camp, residents get intensive exposure to the basics of physiology, perfusion, and basic CT surgical techniques. And through the use of simulators, wet labs, and intensive one-on-one mentoring, the participating residents get a head start on their thoracic surgical education. Just another success fabricated from the imagination of surgeons who recognize the imperative for change and who work constructively towards solution. The regulatory realm of reimbursement has been problematic since the introduction of the RBRVS. The resource-based relative value system. Our specialty has been subjected to repeated cuts in reimbursement, a situation which engenders no small amount of frustration and anger. But SCSA members like Peter Smith saw an opportunity for change and decided to manage it for the benefit of our specialty. 6 years ago, he took up the position of chair of the nomenclature committee of the STS and the AATS, the body that deals with AMA and Medicare regarding reimbursement. Since that time, Peter has effectively reversed the trend towards decline for valuation of our services. His utilization of the SCS database and his mastery of the arcane details of the RBRVS has enabled our specialty to consistently achieve increases in the values ascribed to our codes. Many other SCSA members have stepped forward to try and manage direct change. especially the tight being forced on us in Washington. John Meyer and Jeff Rich have been active for years in D.C., building relationships with Congress, CMS, and other regulatory agencies so that our voice will be heard now and in the future. Similar active change management can be demonstrated in the area of government-sponsored quality improvement. CMS is requiring PQRI data for all specialties, a mandate that requires many hours of work to satisfy for very little payoff. Enter the FREDs. Or you can call them Fred Squared. SCSA members Fred Grover and Fred Edwards addressed the problem of change with an innovative plan which allows direct reporting of quality indicators from the SCSA database directly to CMS without additional surgeon work. These two gentlemen recognize the opportunity to manage change effectively on behalf of our specialty. It's these type of members that we should that should serve as our examples to all of us of what we can and should achieve in the coming years. Either we will learn the lessons of change or we will succumb to them. Truths about change, four immutable truths, two of which I think Tim alluded to. And it's true with the healthcare system. Change has always been. Though we think of it as something that plagues our generation specifically, change has been occurring since the time of Hippocrates. Back then, everybody complained too, only they had to do it in ancient Greek. Change will continue, only faster. We can mourn as much as we like, but it will come at us, wave after wave, and it's something we just have to dig into and deal with. The world is moving faster, medical knowledge doubles every 7 years, and technological advances will accelerate. All of this will result in increasingly rapid change necessitating nimbleness, ingenuity, and resiliency on the part of our specialty and all of us. Change requires hard work and dedication. But you know, as much as we bitch about it, that's nothing new for any of us and nothing we can't handle. You made it through med school. You made it through two grueling residencies. You consistently work harder than any other specialty in medicine. If you can pull a 78-year-old man with an ascending section back from the brink of death at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning, you sure as hell can handle the change that's going to come at you. All you got to do is make up your mind to deal with it. And this is probably the most important one. The future does not belong to us. So often we're trying to mold the change, to make the change fit our desires, our wants, our value systems. We should not be trying to manage change just to make our lives better, but rather to improve the healthcare delivery for our present patients and our future patients and for the practitioners who will come after us. I've learned this from my own children. They're dogma, their mores, their principles, their values are not necessarily the same as ours. It's their future, not ours. We've got to prepare the future appropriately for our future patients and for those following us. We like to think of ourselves as that there are many smart people and there are lots of other smart people in the world. The changes required to institute electronic health records, revamp the payment system, work the healthcare delivery system, and to modernize resident education. We like to think those could all be handled by economists, sociologists, education PhDs, people who have an interest in endless mind-numbing committee meetings, bureaucratic maneuvers, and administrative minutia. One would hope they would not have to depend heavily on old-fashioned clinical practitioners like us, and that we could just stay in our clinics and in our ORs and do the job we've been trained to do. But that's just not the case. It's we thoracic surgeons who possess the common sense and the real-world experience necessary to optimize the process of change in the delivery of thoracic healthcare. Believe it or not, it will be up to us to make it work. This very fact reminds me of a great quote from Jerry Garcia, lead singer of the Grateful Dead. He said, "Somebody has to do something, and it's just incredibly pathetic that it has to be us." But it's true. I swear it's true. If we don't do it, they're going to screw it up. It has to be us, and it has to be now. We're already pretty accomplished at evolving our clinical practice, learning new procedures, new technologies. But for us to thrive in the 21st century, we must be involved in government in formulating health policy. That will require not just involvement of the political arms of our associations, but participation by each of you, individual members, whether it's contacting legislatures, and sure as hell every one of you needs to be donating to the PAC. You must be involved in the design and the assessment of healthcare delivery systems, not only on a national level, but also on your local levels. When they form that accountable care organization in your neighborhood, in your city, if you're not there, you're going to be left in the dust. We're the ones who can help modify EHRs at each of our facilities so they make sense for our practice and for our patients. The academicians among us must continue their efforts to redesign training to attract new and better applicants to ensure a steady supply of thoracic surgeons for the future. We need to take our rightful place at the table or it will be taken from us. And the old DC adage is correct. If you're not sitting at the table, you will soon find yourself on the menu. Thoracic surgeons, both individually and collectively, need to face the oncoming change, seize the opportunity to evolve, and carve out our new niche within the healthcare system. We cannot give in to the desire to hold on to the status quo, to stay in our rut. After all, the only difference between a rut and a grave are the dimensions of the hole. We should not give in to apathy, angst, or anger. Rather, we need to take it upon ourselves to be proactive, navigate the changes before us. In order for us to survive, we must heed the imperative for change, and if we do so, our specialty will continue to prevail. I'd like to thank the association for the privilege of serving as your president. Thank you.